This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Francis Nally and Brandon Adamson. We're going to be discussing my new novel, A Journey to Vapor Island. Great talking to you guys.
Hey, Robert.
Hello.
Brandon, you wrote a lengthy review of the novel, but I gotta say, it's the kind of thing where if I had to write a promo of my novel, it's the kind of thing I would have written.
Well, thank you. I didn't realize it was such a glowing review, but I guess it contains the good, bad, and the bad.
And the cover is, the cover art is by Mark Villard, but I think that really captures what the novel's all about. That's the one you use is not the one in the official book cover. There's an interesting story behind that.
Yeah, I don't know. The cover is amazing, though. I think that, like, he did such a great job on the cover that people would want to buy this book even if it was like a complete piece of shit. Like, the cover is so good that people would want it.
So the one you used is the one with the Pepes. I decided, with the whole sort of, you know, the whole kind of Matt Fury lawsuits going on, I decided to, the official book cover for that I'm using on Lulu, I edited those out, in the book I don't explicitly say Pepe the Frog, but there's a kind of reference to the men in the frog mask.
Yeah, frogmen. Yeah, I don't know. I would have. I think you should have left him in. Like, I think that if they're, it would help the publicity for the book if he did try to do anything. You know, and I find it, you know, hard to believe that, you know, someone could read this book and it really is so it's so chaotic in appearance, like, to an outsider, that I don't think that they could extrapolate, you know, that it's some kind of like run-of-the-mill kind of like alt-right narrative, you know, like something like what I think like Baked Alaska's book or something got shut down because it had Pepe on the cover. But I mean, that's like totally like you know, that's like just a generic kind of alt-right take. It's not something like this where it's, you know, it's not going to be taken that way, I don't think.
What were you originally expecting to get out of the novel before you read it?
Well, I was expecting it to be filled with references to all of your particular obsessions and, you know, just the countless topics you're obsessed about, and you know, cultural figures and things like that you've done umpteen million shows about, everything from like Alicia Silverstone to architecture, you know, city planning, and you know, the Crush, and all of these different, you know, there's so many of them you wouldn't even really know how to say. Yeah, Aleister Crowley, like.
Oh, I actually based the Crush and the story. My inspiration for the Crush and the story was on Alicia Silverstone in that film.
Yeah, and I like how there is random references to 80s songs, like, you know, Heaven is a Place on Earth and things like that appear like randomly. I think they really give it a little bit of a... they really add something to the ambiance, those little, or the Phil, there's like a Phil Collins, I think, reference in there somewhere.
Oh, the part where he has the song, like,
Yeah, it's just where he's, like, riding in the car or something.
Or, yeah, or this one, like, scene where he's thinking of a cheesy song by the Spice Girls, and he's like, I have to think of, like, aristocratic music. Bach, Beethoven, Phil Collins.
Right, and it's just, there's subtle things, but they totally contribute to the aesthetic that, you know, that you're trying to get across to the reader.
I like how you start off your review with that quote, the one about where they approach the Galleria and the main character, Gnome, he wants to check out the architecture, and Carlos jokes, Gnome, you're still such a nerd. The only architecture I'll be exploring is that of a male, is that of the male anatomy. And that's a reference. You put that out on your Twitter feed.
Yeah, well, I showed that quote to someone, you know, who was like kind of a regular listener to the show, and he's like, yeah, of course Stark would find a way to insert like his nerdy like architecture stuff into the story. But I mean, I think that was very like, of course, like there's a lot more architectural, you know, components to the book, but like, it's just funny that like, you know, the ways in which that that it gets inserted into the story like that.
Yeah, so you list all these different themes in the show. I think Leisure Suit, yeah, Pepe, you say Alicia Silverstone, Pepe the Frog, Leisure Suit Larry.
Well, yeah, and there's, I don't know, I think I list a lot of them, but there's a ton more in there that I'm just not even aware of, because, like, you know, I don't, like, listen to like the Asian themes show, so like I don't even know what half of that shit is, so like you know, but I guarantee you there's like, I can tell when other things are brought up that I'm like, oh, that's obviously one of his obsessions too. I just, like, you know, I just didn't listen to that show, you know, so I don't know about it.
Francis, you helped write a few scenes for the book, so some of that is a little bit of your input.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the first time I came on The Stark Truth was actually last year, I think November 3rd was my debut performance, and at the time you had on Martin Shrimp, and I didn't actually know what the show was about, but I think around by the end of November, you were working on this project, which was super secret, and you didn't want to tell anything about it, and after some ritual...
I started it around October of 2016, so it took about a year to finish.
Yeah, and about some weird rituals, I got in on the project, and you sent me this weird rough draft project, and I was quite amazed by it, and you had the strict discipline not to tell anybody about it, that it was super secret and private information. And as you were writing that, it's funny, because as we were having all these guests in, and we were talking from things that I liked to basically guest I was getting on the show, it basically crept into the work you were writing, such as the infamous Anne Frank manga scene, which
that's from a book you got. It's a Japanese textbook that you got at this bookstore.
I think it's by Next Company or something, and it's for children, and basically tells Japanese kids about the life of Anne Frank, but she's just this little anime girl that completely is irrelevant with the whole Jewish thing, but it makes it look like it's porn or something. But yeah, I have that copy upstairs along with a Martin Luther King Jr. one, and little stuff like that, and whether it's from Kazeki Tokinu Uta or Patario and stuff I liked directly, is in, as you could say, the end of 2016 to all of 2017 Robert Stark podcasts at least make a reference within Journey to Vapor Island.
And you make this point, Brandon, that there, we have to give out a disclaimer that this book is not for people who are squeamish about sex or easily offended or shocked.
Yeah, and, you know, that really by pretty much anything, there's stuff in the book to offend almost every kind of person. But I'd say that, you know, particularly someone who is, like, alt-right and...
Or especially the whole trad crowd.
Especially the more, like, prudish, like, you know, traditionalist kind of wing of the alt-right, like the you know, the Little House on the Prairie, like Wheatfields and, you know, reactionary types. The I think that also just the people who are obsessed with, like, you know, fighting degeneracy and, like, that, you know, that you know, definitely anyone who has, like, you know, problems stomaching you know, homoeroticism and homosexuality, like, I mean, I'm, like, pretty open-minded, and there are even scenes in there where I'm like, gee, I wish I could kind of skip over this part, you know? Like,
oh, yeah, you compare them to fighting the monster in old video games from Super Nintendo, where it's something...
No, like, fighting the random battles, which you probably don't know this because maybe you never played some of these RPGs, but, like, the old...
I played The Legend of Zelda and Super Mario Brothers on Super Nintendo.
Yeah, no, not like those, but in, like, the old Final Fantasy games, like, for Super Nintendo, as you would, like, walk across the overworld, like, every few steps you would take, like, you would have to fight, like, a random battle, like, the screen would just switch into battle mode, and you'd have to, like, fight some monsters, like, in the forest or something like that, and it becomes, like, very, very tedious while you're playing the game, because, like, you really just want to, like, go to the next town and, like, you know, talk to the townspeople and advance the story of the game, you know, get to the next place you're going to, and you have to constantly fight these random battles, and they're a real pain in the ass, but, like, when you get to, you kind of understand, like, why they're, like, an important part of the game, and you can't just, like, walk around.
So you're saying
it's part of the experience, like, overall, so it's like...
They're
necessary the same thing with the book.
To the plot.
Well, they're necessary to the plot, but they're also necessary as part of, you know, when you get to the end, like, it makes you feel like more like you've gone on a journey, you know, as opposed to if it was just easy to just walk around the overworld and whatnot, like, having to fight these tedious random battles kind of, like, it just overall adds to the experience of accomplishing this, you know, something that you really went on, like, an epic kind of quest. And that's kind of how I relate it to the book, is that you're reading the book and you're, like, you're anxious to see, like, him go someplace on the island and check out some new building or something like that, and then oh boy, there's another one, like, it, and you could start to see, like, it's going into it, like, going into a sex scene for, like, 10 pages or something like that, and then you're kind of anxious to get to the next, but when you get to the end, you kind of you realize how it really contributes to the whole overall narrative, like, it's just part of it.
You described it as a never-ending story for adults?
Well, kind of. It's like, kind of like a not-quite alt-right version of the never-ending story, but for adults, just because, especially as I was reading in the beginning, like, the plot is very kind of similar, like, he has this old book that he got, and he's, like, he's kind of bullied, and so he, like, retreats into his own imagination, and this, and then this kind of imaginative world that he creates, like, he's in charge of making wishes, and, like, and it works. It's kind of a weird parallel to it, but it would be, like, the never-ending story, like, if you included, like racism and misogyny and, like, homoeroticism and, like, rampant sexual behavior and just all kinds of, like, other weirdness and depravity, but I think if you—I don't know if you've ever even seen that film, but I think if you watched it,
I saw it as a,
like,
kid, but it was quite some time ago.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it in the theater when it came out, and it just struck me, especially in the beginning, because, like, he has, like, old book and photos and things like that, and then it's kind of like, wow, this is kind of like the never-ending story. But but, you know, obviously, would like to stress that it is not for children.
Yeah, I also think it's not for large segments of adults either.
Yeah, I mean,
I do think a lot of the book is kind of like a video game, and I did get inspiration from that, because there's the dialogue scenes, but there's large segments of the book that are just about exploration, like where Gnome is exploring different parts of the island. Were you a fan of those parts in particular?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, because I think that's where you we have somewhat similar views, and I think that that's where you get to kind of lay out like your kind of utopian vision of society, like which is almost something you could only really do when in like a video game, you know, constructing this kind of utopian kind of island that really contains all the elements that, like, you know, that, like, if we were billionaires, we would make an island that is like has these types of things and this kind of aesthetic, and it's kind of a shame that, like, a lot of the people who are actually billionaires are actually just so unimaginative and just build like the most boring shit. I mean, just look at like a Walmart, you know, like how much money the company has, and like the buildings just look like the most basic, like, stupid thing. Like, absolutely, you would think you would do something cool if you had a chance to make stores like this. Yeah, that kind of money. But I guess that's the difference between someone who only cares about money and someone who cares about their you know, their bizarre aesthetic.
That kind of reminds me of the scene where Gnome is exploring the palace and he ends up in Meshul's quarter. Ari Meshul's a film director, and he just says, he's like, this isn't like magnificent, this is like your generic mansion you'd expect to find in LA in the early 21st century.
Yeah, and he's like a big shot on the island, but you can tell like he's just kind of in it for the money or status or something, when he doesn't even really appreciate the aesthetic of the island and the buildings on it. And you can see he's just like, in reality, like he's a fraud, like he's a total just normie.
You said he reminds you of what's his name, Harvey Weinstein.
Well, a little bit. I think that, like, he kind of reminds me of like a more of like a younger kind of sleazy kind of Jewish director. I'm trying to think of, I can't remember the dude's name who directed like one of the new Star Wars, but I mean, you know who, you'd know him if you saw him. I can't remember his name, but I think that, like, it's definitely very timely with Harvey Weinstein because of just that, you like, you wrote this kind of with him, like someone like him vaguely in mind, and,
well, I was kind of vaguely, vaguely thinking about this, but I wrote this before all the allegations came out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it wasn't like you wrote it before, you know, months and months before this stuff hit it big, and it's just kind of it's kind of interesting, especially the way that Meshul's character ends up in the book, that it's kind of like it's kind of an eerie correlation.
With the whole Vapor Island, that's obviously a reference to Vaporwave.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, and, you know, visually the book, it makes that pretty apparent, but it's also kind of, it's also, I think, a little bit more than Vaporwave, because I don't think that even Vaporwave even really addresses the kind of complexity of the society that's in the book. I mean, just maybe like visually a little bit, but there's obviously much more to your construction of the aesthetic than just strictly, you know, vaporwave. You know, there's a lot more to it.
You know, it's interesting that the book, it's kind of in three parts, maybe two parts. I think it's three parts. I don't want to spoil the book, but you have this part when he's like growing up, and it like takes place in like, seems like 80s or 90s or even today society of the nerd against the bullies. Then there's a part where there's a transitional phase where he goes to jail. And then there's a third part where it's the future, and it's in the futuristic society, whatever you want to call it, Blade Runner or some generic vaporwave Japanese anime is real city. And with that certain aesthetic, it's interesting.
Oh,
because
so there's a scene where he goes to New York City and he visits that sex robot brothel. You're referring to that?
Yeah, that's an interesting scene too. But I think it blends in because it's like science fiction to like realistic young adult, like Judy Blum fiction to like, and it kind of all this makes sense in this weird artistic avant-garde sense where it plays a joke on everything, and like it definitely gets really crafty but also at the same time very silly, as you know, he goes to the sex brothel, tons of racial and sex jokes that are hilarious. Like, literally every scene in the book is just memorable, comically, whether it be three or four sentences.
There's something outrageous, like, in almost every paragraph. I had my girlfriend read through part of it, and, like, you know, she only, like, made it through, like, one page, like, on, like, page 50 or something, and she was, like, just, she's like, I can't read this. Like, it was too much for her. Like, I mean, she just happened to, like, you know, start on that page where they're, like, in class, and, you know, there's that memorable part where the Chads are, like, you know, Irumashio, that sounds gangster, bro. And, like, my girlfriend was like, okay, like, that's enough. Like, I'm done.
What do you think about the whole Roger Blackstone character? He's this kind of shadowy figure. He never actually appears, but he's this fictional presidential candidate who you could say he's vaguely Trump-like, but he's not supposed to be like a represent Trump. You described him, he could easily be Ross Perot or even Willy Wonka.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of like a combination of all those kind of people. He's not like a direct stand-in for anyone, really, or like a replica of like Trump or Ross Perot. Like, in a sense, he's similar to Trump because he's like a wealthy and you know, into women, and he has like a casino, but he's also I don't think that really Trump's political views are really, like, his worldview is really like coherent enough to go along with someone like Blackstone. I think maybe Trump is like what people project onto Trump is actually, you know, might be similar to Blackstone, but in terms of like the actual guy, no. But I think more so like a Willy Wonka, because he has kind of a more imaginative, outlandish kind of world that he's able to create. He's kind of more of an eccentric.
Yeah, like the whole island, you could make the case it's like an adult version of Willy Wonka's factory.
Exactly.
Especially the erotic emporium.
Yeah, well, that is my favorite scene in the book.
What do you think about Roger Blackstone's whole political theories? And they also kind of align with Noam's own views.
Well, I'm sympathetic to them, obviously. I think that they kind of combine a lot of the, you know, what I would perceive to be the best of the right and the left, and also the best aesthetics, but you know, others would probably disagree. And he kind of combines, I think, similar to our views, where it's like kind of a mixture of like you know, race realism and sex realism with environmentalism and like architecture and futurism, and also like sexual openness and very like kind of anti-corporate economics, even though Blackstone himself is like, you know, a billionaire.
Kind of like the fantasy that people had about Trump, and now they're disillusioned about.
Well, maybe the fantasy we had about Trump. I think to a lot of like normie Republicans, like, you know, their fantasy was, you know, maybe that he was going to like, you know, blow up ISIS or something like that, you know. But in terms of like, you know, weirdos like us that maybe projected weird things on him just based on, you know, his statements in relation to the other like really horrible candidates. Yeah.
And I do have that whole debate scene. So I do have these fictional candidates. So there's a Republican, Wilbur Rex Jackson III, and that's obviously a play on Trump's cabinet members. And then there's the Democrat, what's his name, Dave Cohen Rodriguez, and the students in the class, in Noam's class, are assigned fictional presidential candidates, and they have to make the case for that, but then it gets really personal.
Yeah, and, you know, what impresses me about the debate scene, really, and you don't see this too often, but all of the different political sides that are represented in the debate are done so, like, very authentically. Like, it's not like a giant, straw man or anything when it's like each side really argues its case very authentically, like how they actually would and how it would put kind of their best foot forward on their views. Like, you know, when you watch a movie or something, or you read a book, and it will portray, like, you know, the candidate who's like the villain or something like that, it will portray their views as just being kind of like an absurd caricature almost. So it presents like a false choice to the viewer of, like, you especially see this like in movies where there's like a Republican and a Democrat, and then the Republican will be like this total, really like stereotypically like unlikable person who it
well,
just
that
gives,
actually
like,
wasn't my intention with the Democrat and the Republican. I was kind of playing off of negative caricatures that political dissidents have of Republicans and Democrats.
You know, perhaps, but when you read it, and, you know, for example, when you read, like, even just the, whatever, like, the normie, like, neoconservative, his statement in the debate is, like, I mean, to us it may seem absurd, but it's really exactly what that person would argue, actually, and it's, like, the way that they would actually say it. Now, just because, like, we don't, like, swallow it up or aren't sympathetic to it, I found it to be very authentic, the way that each of these people was really allowed to make their case the way that they actually would.
And let's talk about the gnome character himself. Francis, what was your take on the gnome character starting from the beginning?
Well, gnome certainly reminds me of a Jewish version of Elliot Rodgers throughout the entire book. One thing that is funny is that his narrative about himself is exactly like Elliot Rodger, and whatever he does, he doesn't seem to learn. Basically, you know, Elliot Rodgers goes ahead and shoots six people and kills himself, but Gnome, he basically is unapologetic about being Elliot Rodgers. There's so much in the, you know, internet media right now that basically condemns a quote-unquote beta male cuck, when you could make the argument and say Gnome is the beta male cuck, but he's proud to be that. And it's weird because there's too much MGTOW or PUAing, or maybe the word trad man's going around saying that you have to be alpha or Chad.
Or
and
the
yet,
whole
I think,
thing now, there's like the Chad nationalism's like the meme.
Yeah, douchebaggery. But the point is,
Gnome, and that's actually, I think I even referenced that term in the book.
Well, Gnome never, the comedy is like Gnome never, he's rewarded for being himself and he wins, you know? And that's what's great. And it's just like, it's funny in a way. And it's almost, it's like you kind of, that's why people like Elliot Rodgers. It's this kind of weird, like everybody is Elliot Rodgers inside, and it's okay to be a beta male cuck. There's nothing wrong with it.
Well, he
and
doesn't
funny
view himself that way. He's the one. He views himself as like the ultimate the one true aristocrat.
Yeah,
well,
but
he does. But he's also like, he's also very like, feels very pathetic about himself, and is like, is constantly like, you know, recognizes his own like humiliation. Like he doesn't strike me as like, as being like a proud beta male. He strikes me as being like pretty like pathetic and like, you know, crying, and he's just like feeling sorry for himself. Like, he doesn't really strike me as like a, as being proud. I mean, later on, he seems like almost like, he just continuously gets humiliated, because even when he's like kind of a celebrity later on, then he really, like, he still continues getting humiliated after that. And like, it's not even like, he realizes that, like, even that is, like, kind of a sham.
Do you identify with the gnome character, and do you think the audience will?
I think certain people, I think certain people will. I think that I identify with him in the sense that he's like, you know, he's an outsider type of figure. But I think that he, you know, like I said, maybe it's because I'm older or something, but I don't really identify with like this like incel kind of generation or whatever. It's just totally, you know, alien to me. Like the people who, for what, you know, can't communicate with women or like, you know, go on dates without being like a total retard. Like I, you know, that was never my experience. Like I had a lot of troubles with women, but it was usually like, you know, I found them to be difficult to get along with, like while I was dating them, or it would be like, I would get a girl and be dating her for a while, and then like, she might lose interest or something. But it was never anything that was like on the level of like what you see in these chan, you know, the chans and like at Reddit and where people are just like, you know, no female will even talk to me, and just the kind of weird, creepy like incel cult kind of stuff. Like that's totally like alien to me, and I don't even know what to make of it.
And then Noam develops his crush on this wealthy blonde girl named Natalie Bloom, and he basically has this like lifelong crush on her.
Yeah, well, like right from the beginning, and that's another thing too, is that he somehow likes to pretend in his mind that it is that. That he's all about purity and whatnot, but I think like he has a vision of her like while he's like having a wet dream, like dreaming about going down on her or something like that. So in a sense, like he's kind of like a hypocrite, you know, which you can see right through a lot of his the things he tries to convince himself of throughout the book, you know, even where he just constantly assures himself that he's like a great aristocrat or something like that, when it's like, you know, it's quite obvious that, like, you know, he doesn't really seem to have much charisma or even anything. Like,
what do you think about the betrayal of the Chads? I know you were saying that their dialogue more resembles that of a 90s Wiggers, but when you think of a Chads, you think of your stereotypical 80s movie jocks?
Yeah, like an 80s, like, jock bully, like, probably like the quintessential Chad would be someone like Johnny Lawrence from the original Karate Kid, and just those kind of movies. Just the 80s jock, or the what's his name, Stalin from Better Off Dead, with John Cusack. I think that those are what I conceive as like the ultimate Chads. But when I say that they have the dialogue that resembles like 90s Wiggers, I don't necessarily mean they look or dress like that, but just the way that even like jock people back then would still talk like that, you know, just because it was part of the lexicon. I think that it kind of also maybe even like can be seen just that, but by your age, it kind of like dates to when you went to high school or something like that.
And Francis, what's your general take on the Chads?
You know, I mean, I don't mean to sound like a school shooter or something, but Chads are basically over masculine men who basically follow their instinct of doing gay alpha shit. That's pretty much, I mean, I don't mean to sound like a deconstructionist or something of doing homoeroticism, but there seems to be baby boomers have a problem with the Chad mentality, is because they probably grew up around it, and people like Stephen King or whatever thousand names under the sun always blame that the heteronormal white mom and dad has some evil veneer, and that's by being a soccer Chad, they're going to cause problems. And I guess now we have a fucked up generation of 60-year-olds who want to be eccentric and queer and be like artists, you know. But now we have this weird problem where it's like now we have these like people who want to return to being Chad and being masculine, but want to be intellectual at the same time, whether you want to call that Jack Donovan or something like that, I don't know. Or then you just have gay Chad, like nationalists, who are just basically pussy nerds or like incels. I don't know, but to me, Chads are just normal people. They just don't deserve to be in the avant-garde arts.
And Brandon, how do you generally see the Natalie Bloom character? She actually doesn't talk very much because I wanted to keep a mystique about her.
Yeah, well, I think, I see her as someone really not very, just kind of vapid, and I think that everything that you see is kind of what, like, Noam projects onto her as how you see her. But, you know, if you're reading the story carefully, then you obviously understand that he's projecting, he's putting her on a pedestal and projecting a lot of things onto her when she's probably just like a mostly kind of just normal chick. You know, that's the impression that I get, you know.
I think I was saying originally the inspiration was from the film The Crush. Are you familiar with that film? Familiar with that film?
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a long time.
Oh, but you did. I think you did reference Clueless in your review. What was that about?
Well, I mean, I was talking about Francis kind of alluded to it a little bit, but I think that, like, it's interesting because
Isn't the character Elton is kind of represents the Chad?
Yeah, exactly. And the director also directed Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And, you know, I remarked in my review that a lot of these kind of 80s and 90s films with these, vilifying these Chad types or these jock types were kind of like the, kind of these Jewish directors that were like, Revenge of the Nerds is another one. It's kind of like a subconsciously insecure kind of attack on these like just normal suburban white dudes, and I think that like hostility towards them for some reason, and you see that in the Karate Kid and so many Just One of the Guys and Revenge of the Nerds especially is kind of the ultimate one, but really you see like. In Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you know, the main character is like this almost kind of like Noam, just this kind of nerdy Jewish guy. His name is even Ratner in the story, and he likes this kind of this beautiful, white girl, and then, you know, she sleeps with his asshole, like sleazy, like Italian stud supposed friend. And it's just kind of like you see that theme over and over in those movies. That's kind of like this, where the Chads almost represent like in these writers like some kind of like insecurity or something towards them. And in fact, it's very interesting if you go back and try to watch some of these movies like without any bias and try to look at the other characters that are vilified. If you try to look at it from there. Perspective, like you get an almost different sense of the movie. I think someone actually did that. They made a video of the Karate Kid, but they tried to make it so that like Johnny was the good guy. And I don't know. I thought it was just kind of a joke, but it was very, very interesting.
So I guess different people could interpret this novel differently.
Yeah, and you brought up Clueless. That's the same dynamic there is that. You know, this guy Elton is portrayed as a total asshole and jerk, and then, of course, Alicia Silverstone ends up falling for like her funny Jewish stepbrother who's like cynical and like.
Are you talking about Paul Rudd?
You know, yeah, and the political junkie. You know, like so, it's kind of like, I'm not saying that it's even totally intentional. It's just like if you understand like the subconscious motivations and insecurities of writers like. Those find their way into the stories.
When you have like a vision, do you have like a visual imagery of what Natalie Bloom looks like?
I would say that like something like an Alicia Silverstone or Sarah Michelle Gellar type, like just kind of one of these like young like Jewish like Hollywood starlets, but like you wouldn't necessarily think they were Jewish just by looking at them. Helen Slater would be a good example from the Legend of Billie Jean. You know, someone that you looked at and it's just like this really attractive, you know, blondish girl, but that you wouldn't necessarily, doesn't look really like stereotypically Jewish.
And the thing about it is there's this theme where he doesn't just obsess about her in high school. She's basically the centerpiece of the entire novel.
Yeah, I guess you could say that that's kind of, it's kind of like part of his quest or something. If this were a video game, you know, that would centers upon saving her, which literally is part of the plot, right? I mean, and it even involves him taking like a sword or an axe off the wall. So it does have a very kind of, you know, RPG, almost kind of steampunk element to it.
What do you think about the whole theme of serial killers becoming kind of celebrities in our culture? Because he becomes a celebrity when he gets out of prison, and you do see that. Like, one example is Charles Manson is, he's in prison, obviously, but he is a celebrity in our culture.
Yeah, even, I think Andy Warhol once made a statement about saying, like, even people like Charles Manson were really, like, up there and considered kind of superstars in a way because, you know, they were so huge. And you see that now, even with someone like Elliot Rodger, like, they're not, I mean, he has, like, 50,000 subscribers on YouTube, and he's been dead for years, and he has, like, all kinds of fans and people who relate to his manifesto, even though, like, he committed these rather, like, senseless and, like, horrific crimes. The same thing with, like, the Columbine killers and that, whatever, the Joker shooter from the movie theater in Colorado, James Holmes. So you see that these people have really become these kind of dark celebrities in their own way. And
all of these people, basically, that you're talking about, Elliot Rodgers and the Columbine killers are dead, and the Joker shooter is in prison for life, but the gnome character, he gets out of prison basically when he's in his 30s, and he's walking around free as this celebrity figure. So I don't know if that's happened. Maybe that has happened, but that's basically what happens.
Well, but keep in mind, I think he's like a minor when he, you know, commits these crimes. So that, you know, that wouldn't necessarily
be unfathomable. I think
and
he's given,
he
16,
like,
16 years in prison.
Yeah, and he was also like, you know, he was different than someone like an Elliot Rodger in the sense that, like, you know, Noam was actually kind of like abused and really like bullied in very like criminal ways that, like, a judge may be sympathetic, like, to, you know, to something like that. Like, if you, that's a little bit different than, like, just going into a random, you know, neighborhood and just, like, you know, and just, you know, just shooting random people or something like that. It's not quite the same.
What do you think about the whole theme of the whole commercialization of his manifesto? And you were telling me that reminded you of this movie you saw.
Yeah, well, it reminded me of this Brian De Palma film called Get to Know Your Rabbit, which is like it's about like a it's this executive, right? And he's like, he's overworked and he's got some real important job, and he just walks out one day and decides to quit and become like a tap dancing magician. And then so he just does that because he just wants to have like a simple life. And then his other old boss gets fired, and so he becomes like a bum. And so this guy feels sorry for his old boss, so he lets him, you know, become his like booking agent or something to book these magician gigs. And then it turns out that this other guy turns it into, like, this gigantic corporation, a mega corporation for, like, burnt out executives to become tap dancing magicians, and it totally like ruins the whole thing because it makes it into like he's become another like involved in like a total another like corporate empire where he has all of these responsibilities again and he can't just have fun. And it also reminds me of the legend of Billie Jean, where she basically shoots this guy and she's on the run, and the guy that she shoots actually becomes like, you know, starts selling like memorabilia and like merchandise with her you know, name and stuff. Even though like he's like a sleazy guy and he like tried to rape her, he's still like, you know, cashing in on her notoriety as like being someone running from the cops. So I think that it's just kind of like just ties into the fact that like our society will just commercialize absolutely anything and everything, and they'll do it regardless, just anything to make a buck.
Yeah, there's the whole theme of the commercialization of the whole film. Well, there's the film being made based on his novel, but then there's a certain point in the film, and I think it's around the point of the Erotic Emporium, when he starts to question the island, and he questions whether it's his own utopia or whether it's just some gimmicky tourist attraction.
Well, exactly, and I mean, I've mentioned this before, but the Erotic Emporium is my favorite part of the book, because that's when you finally realize that, like, that the book is a masterpiece and that there's actually kind of a brilliant narrative behind it, whereas for a lot of the beginning portion of the book, it's kind of chaotic and you're kind of thinking, like, oh, a lot of this is just kind of juvenile and meant to shock or whatever. And when you get to the part with the Erotic Emporium, that's when you see like the kind of overarching narrative comes into play, and you're just like, wow, like, I get it now. Like, I understand what the whole book is about. Like, it actually is a coherent book. And I just think that that scene itself is just rather brilliantly visually constructed, in that it's like you realize that the attractions on the island and the are all just like you know, like commercialized like attractions that are just based on like in parts of Noam's manifesto. Like, they're cashing in on the kind of like in a big way. So I think that the Erotic Emporium really is where that not only is it brilliantly done, but it's where you kind of realize that, like, the book all comes together there.
What would you say is the overarching message of the book?
Well, I would say that, I don't know that there even is just one, but I think that, you know, what we touched on is the commercialization of everything, but also this idea that if you live too much in your fantasies, that if you go too deep into your fantasies and you stay there too long, that you'll really be completely out of touch with the world and be unable to function in it like productively and coherently. And I think that is like an important an important component of the book, and that's part of, I think, the journey that Noam goes on, is that he spends a large portion of the book completely indulging in his fantasies and almost totally out of touch with the world around him, even to the extent that he doesn't even like he's delusional about what is actually going on. He's completely deluding himself, and I think that's kind of the journey he goes on, where it's like, well, he's going to have to like get out of his fantasies a little bit while he still can, and then he's going to actually see like how what actually awaits him in the real world.
I think it's interesting that it's Journey to Vapor Island, even though I would suggest Vaporwave Island, and this is also something I want to bring up as well. I mean, this is probably just the first alpha copy of the book, and hopefully maybe a publisher will pick it up. I was on the website on Lulu right now. It says The Journey to Vapor Island, and unfortunately, even in the book, it says The Journey to Vapor Island. However, I think even though it's supposed to be, you know, Journey to Vapor Island, I think the beginning of it reminds me of something like The Journey to the Center of the Night or The Naked Lunch or this French like le thing. It gives it this weird sophistication to it or something like that. But looking at the book cover right now, I realized that actually the spine happens to be on the front cover as well. Now, I don't know if you want to call that a vaporwave
effect.
No,
I got the same book. It's not a mistake. That was part of the original Mark Villard design that he commissioned, that he did.
Oh. Well, I guess if that's true, I mean, it's just, it does remind me of this strange brand thing where, I mean, it does have a spine from the Lulu edition, but not a picturesque spine. I always thought the purpleness, it's interesting. I don't know, but just looking over it and looking over the entire book in its entirety, I do believe maybe one day these self-published copies of the book might become collector's items from 2017 simply because that they were in the possession of a small group of artistic people like us that had these copies.
Yeah, and yeah, that's true. And like I said, I think that if you had, it would almost be a kind of a shame if a publisher actually picked up this book, because it would be kind of ironic, because they would have to, you know, to censor it and gut so much out of it that it would almost be like in the book when the movie that's made about Milam's life, how it's completely like sanitized and changed, the meeting is totally changed, like in order to make it commercially
10%
viable.
Of proceeds would be donated to Chad Relief.
Oh boy.
Someone needs to make this into a film, or it even work as an anime.
I mean, there's Richard Wollstonecraft, but I'm not so sure he's busy with his own thing, so.
I mean, the only way that this could be made into a film, I think, is if it was something like a Murdoch type thing, where he had like a real kind of autist, like just went through and made like kind of a really bizarre and epic, you know, art, like avant-garde internet cartoon type deal. And I don't know, but I think that like it'll be interesting, the marketing, because I would always like mail out my books, and that would be like one of the ways I would market, but like you can't really mail out this book, like there's just a little bit too much like depravity in it. And you know, like in my book was like somewhat offensive, but it's like this, like, you know, you can't just mail this to a place, because, like, what if, like, a kid opens it up or something? Like, I mean, you just opening yourself up to, like, all kinds of problems. So I think that the marketing part is interesting, because you're going to have to find really creative ways to market this book.
Who do you think is the core demographic for an audience for the book?
I would say that it would largely be, like, kind of the internet weirdos and like anime, you know, anime nerds and kind of like just anyone, I think anyone kind of who's really into meme culture, but that also has like a really high tolerance for being offended, you know, because I mean, kind of like everyone is into meme culture now, but I think that like, you know, there's definitely a certain demographic that wouldn't be able to stomach the contents of this book, you know.
I think we did touch upon this, but when you think about the whole theme about the obsession with sex and how that defines one's status, and that's an ongoing theme throughout the book to the very beginning, and that's like a theme that influences both the Gnome's Manifesto and the whole basically mechanisms of the island itself.
Yeah, the whole island is just almost kind of like one giant, like, sex organ or something that's, like, you know, working in cohesion. But, like, I think that that's important, because when you're reading the book, like, it kind of, it reminds you a little bit of, like, adolescence and, like, how you just like kind of so like sex is like such a huge deal in your mind that you're like so obsessed with it and like, you know, getting laid and you know, the stuff. And I think that like as you get older, it's just kind of like you read, you know, you read this and you just want to like tell Noam like, dude, like, you know, it's just not that, it's just not that, sex just isn't that big of a deal. Like, I think another quote by Andy Warhol said, like, you know, sex is the biggest nothing of all time, or like, you know, sex is more exciting, like, you know, on TV than Between the Sheets or something
kind of
like that.
Between the pages, there's that scene where he runs into that actress he loses his virginity to, and she, but before they finally have sex, she's like, no one on the island actually has regular sex, but like, you can change this.
Yeah, that's, it's kind of funny because that is also like how like 4chan and these places are, like, that everyone is so into these like bizarre fetishes and things like that, that no one is just like, you know, like your dad, like looking at Playboy or something, like that's just so, like, there's just, that's like nothing like what these people don't even want, like intercourse. They have want some kind of weird, weird thing. And I think that the scene with him losing his virginity is particularly kind of realistic, because I think that is really part of like a coming of age, is that like, you know, you kind of dream of like losing your virginity to some, like, to this hot chick, and that it's like your crush or whatever, and you like, you work up to it and you get this hot girl and you're finally getting laid. It's just like a porno. But really what ends up happening is that, like, you know, you get drunk at a party or something, and some, like, you know, really aggressive girl, like, just is like, you know, goes, and you're just like, oh, well, you know, whatever, I guess I'll do it, you know. And then, like, you feel like shit afterwards, but then, like, you kind of feel like it moves you closer to be a man, because you're kind of, like, a little bit more hardened after that that experience.
I guess one more thing is, what is your thought on the whole Carlos de la Boca character?
It's really funny, and he's really gay, and he makes a gay joke every sentence. And the best scene in the book is probably when Noam finds out his love for him later on in the future, and it's certainly my favorite scene in the entire book.
Okay, so, yeah, I'm not sure what your inspiration for Carlos was, but I think that he's, like, extremely authentic. Like, he actually reminds me of, like, just his dialect and just his, you know, the words he uses and stuff, the way he talks, the syntax. Like, he actually reminds me of, like, Mexican or, like, Puerto Rican dudes that I knew that were, like, you know, that you work at like, a shady, like, telemarketing place or something like that. Like, he actually talks just like those kind of dudes, and has kind of the same attitude of like this weird combination of like gangster and like homoerotic, but also like, you know, very laid back, you know what I mean? Like, he kind of talks,
yeah,
like a wigger, but like, he's also like homoerotic. It just kind of like this weird, like, you know, Puerto Rican dude or something that you would see it like a discount, working at like Discount Tires or something like that, or like a telemarketing place. Just, I worked with so many dudes like that I was just really impressed by, like how realistic his character was. I mean, even though he's like totally absurd. Also,
do you have any other thoughts on the other side characters? Like, there's Zach, Lisa, Wendy, Molly, and those other side characters.
Well, I like Wendy's character, I think, because I don't know, I just find her to be kind of likable, even though she's like a huge bitch. But I think it's funny that she has that cunnilingus party, and that becomes kind of the you know, the basis for what later is like the erotic emporium. But I find it's funny that there's this little tidbit in there where Meshel's daughter or something, actually on her bookshelf she has like The Art of the Cunnilingus Party by Wendy Silverstein, like, book is on her bookshelf. Like, I thought that was a nice touch, and that's like, that's one of the, it's those kind of details in the book that I just think are like just priceless, like, that really, like, you know, drive the book home to me.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, either Brandon or Francis, is there anything else you'd like to add about the book?
Well, I just wanted to say that it's really a masterpiece, and it's one of the most creative and imaginative and depraved books I've ever read. And like, I wasn't really expecting much when I read it, because it's like, oh, you know, Robert wrote a book, and you know. But when I got to a certain point, I realized that like, this is really like kind of one of the best books I've ever read, and it's just incredibly imaginative in just in ways that are totally unpredictable, and it's just really, really a great book. You know, the Journey to Vapor Island. I recommend that. You know, this is a journey that's not for everyone, but that you want to go on this journey and read this book.
I think at a total of probably 340 pages without any chapter breaks, this is definitely almost like a comic book in a way, where you can certainly start to finish of the book and to end the book, but once again, there's moments in every paragraph, and the narrative has little secrets in it, where as we're writing, you know, everyone writing this and putting into the project, whether that be people, you know, whether we're talking about podcasts on the Stark Truth or esoteric ideologies, it's all in here. It's just hidden well through certain pages, and I think it is definitely also a work of art I take pride in, and I'm proud to be a part of this project, and I think Journey to Vapor Island needs its utmost attention, and I hope it gets picked up by something bigger in the future.
Brandon Adamson and Francis Nally, it's been an excellent show. Thanks, guys, for being on.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.